if you can wade into the political arena and make it out unscathed, you must be doing something right.
Brian Burke is your host for Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Welcome to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. I am not Brian Burke. I'm James Sebastian Scott, filling in for Brian. Listen, I just want to be honest off the top here. I know I said Brian was going to be back today. That's not the case. I'm in the chair. But we still have some stuff left over for you, the listener, from the provincial government. And we'll head to that Q&A right now from the province.
Okay, we're ready to move to the phone lines for questions. First question, please.
From Rob Ferguson with the Toronto Star. Please go ahead.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Premier and or Dr. Moore. I'm just wondering, since in the past you've had to kind of pause or delay some of these reopenings, I'm wondering what specifically you would be looking at that would kind of be the tripwire for having to pause or temporarily halt these kind of measures. What are the key things you're looking at?
I'll pass that, Dr. Moore.
Thanks, Rob. So just in particular, it's not one number that we're monitoring. It is a series of data points. As the Premier announced, the percentage of tests that are positive is on the decline at 15%. So that is one indicator we're following very closely. As well, the ability to care for Ontarians in the intensive care unit setting, as well as in the hospital. Thank you to all the healthcare workers that continue to provide care. We're at 100% capacity for the medical and surgical beds, but we are providing care for COVID patients in the right place at the right time. The other metric is the number of outbreaks in long-term care facilities in particular, because patients have to move eventually from the acute care sector back into long-term care or from long-term care back into the acute care sector. So those are some of the metrics that we're following, as well as the ability to care for individuals in the health sector. And the Premier already mentioned the number of people that are not in the workplace because they've called in sick. We're seeing improvement in those metrics, and they're plateauing in terms of the hospital use. We anticipate by the 31st that there will be ongoing improvements, but February will be difficult as well. We absolutely anticipate the need to have continued ICU capacity for patients, and hence the Premier's call to continue to get immunized, to continue to come forward for the third doses will be important every day going forward. 11 days till the opening, and we want a million more Ontarians coming forward. We can immunize more than 100,000 a day. So important that anyone with an underlying medical illness in Ontario get their third dose, especially those that are 50 and older. And there are appointments available across Ontario to do that over the next several days. So please take advantage of the availability of vaccine.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Doctor. You were mentioning that everyone with COVID is getting the care they need, but a lot of people with needing cancer and other surgeries and heart procedures and whatnot are still on this pause. When will you lift that so that hospitals can get more back to normal? And when do you think, under the timelines for reopening, that you'll be able to get back to broader PCR testing than we're having now, with mostly limited to healthcare workers and people at high risk?
Well, it's very unfortunate that we had to provide Directive 2 to pause non-emergent, non-urgent surgeries. If people do have a life-threatening condition, of course, they will still receive the care that they need. But we know that many people are upset and frustrated at having their surgeries pushed off yet again. We want to get back on track with them as soon as we can. But that, as you know, both hospitalizations and admissions to ICU are lagging indicators. So we don't expect the peak of the admissions to ICU to happen until about mid-February, early first, second week of February. So as soon as we can see that the numbers are going down, both in terms of admissions to hospital and in terms of intensive care admissions, then we'll be able to get back on track with those surgeries and procedures because, as I said, this is a very difficult decision to make, but one that we had to do to preserve our hospital capacity in terms of beds, but also in terms of health human resources. But I will ask Dr. Moore to perhaps comment further on that.
Thank you, Rob. Again, for the testing strategy, we take advice from the expert panel on testing and from our laboratory partners. We do have good capacity within the PCR system to review our testing criteria at present. Again, therefore, the most vulnerable long-term care facilities, hospitals, those that need treatment, those with comorbidities, and First Nations, Inuit, Métis. But we're regularly reviewing the criteria for PCR testing. Again, this province has also been very aggressive in making available rapid antigen tests, so 3.9 million distributed this week through our education partners. So we're going to try to have a balanced approach between the access to RAT tests, both prioritized, but also having a population level access to RATs as well as to the PCR. So going forward, we want a balance between those two testing modalities. Clearly, the more labor intensive and the more difficult to get, so you have to go to an assessment center, you have to wait, get the swab done for PCR testing. We're limiting it specifically to those high risk populations and settings. And I hope the public, as we have more RATs generally available, will take advantage of them because I do believe they're much more convenient, done in the calm of your home, and you have an answer within minutes instead of waiting several days for the PCR results.
Next question.
Your next question comes from Richard Southern with City News 680. Please go ahead.
Hi, Premier. Good morning. Premier, you said at the beginning of the month that restaurants, gyms, and movie theaters were closing to protect hospitals. Can you then tell us today why restaurants, gyms, and movies are reopening before elective surgery is resuming?
Well, I'll just repeat what I said earlier on, Richard. There was three areas of focus. Number one is when we saw the hospitalizations double every single week. We saw the positivity rate go right up to 40%. Now we've seen it drop down to 15.9%. And everyone saw the absenteeism in your own workplace, not to mention the healthcare sector. You know, and we're doing everything we can to make sure we bolster the healthcare system. Keep in mind, folks, I'm going to go back a little bit here. The Liberal government fired 1,600 nurses. Our healthcare system was not in good shape when we took office. Since then, we've hired over 6,700 healthcare workers. We're going to be bringing in another 6,000 in March. We're putting billions and billions of dollars into the healthcare system. We want to make sure that we're prepared for any future pandemic. We've put in tens of billions of dollars into infrastructure and building new hospitals right across this province, and we're going to continue to invest in our health care. But we can't do it alone. No province can do it alone. Since I've been elected, we've been on the federal government for the CHT, the Canadian Health Transfers. We are paying, as Ontarians, 78% of the cost. The federal government, and it's not just this federal government, it's prior federal governments, I don't care if it's conservative or liberal, they're pitching in 22%. That's unacceptable. Every single premier is in line with making sure that the federal government pays their fair share of health care. And it's not one-time funding that we're looking for. We need continuous funding, nonstop, until we can hire more health care workers, until we can take care of our nurses, until we can continue bringing in new technology and building new hospitals. But I can tell you every single premier is in line on this. We're going to have a meeting today with all the premiers. We need the federal government to step up. It's very simple. We will not be able to move forward, not only as a province, as a country, with the federal government pitching in 22% and putting the vast majority of the burden on the backs of the provinces.
Follow up.
Okay, follow up for Dr. Moore. Dr. Moore, there's a letter posted online appearing to be from you addressed to the Niagara Region Chief Medical Officer of Health, in which you, quote, express concern with measures he's taking with schools in that region, including weekly CO2 monitoring in classrooms, the dismissal of cohorts if there's a positive case, and the use of medical exemption notes for masks. Is that letter accurate, sir? Cannot local medical officers of health make their own decisions? And Dr. Moore, what's so wrong with these measures?
So we meet with our medical officers of health on a regular basis. We have consultation to them from this office to local public health, and I thank all the local public health officials for all their work they're doing to protect the health of their communities, both through vaccination and case and contact management and outbreak management. What I'm trying to have across Ontario is a consistent and persistent approach so that parents, school boards, families can expect the same level of protection and care. And so I did have a conversation with Niagara to understand a different approach. That medical officer of health informed me of why they're making them, and that dialogue continues. And I have the similar dialogue with health units across this province through my regional associate chief medical officers of health. So I think all Ontarians should be assured that we're in regular partnership with our local public health agencies, that we communicate, we collaborate with them, and we try to ensure consistent and persistent approaches across Ontario.
Next question.
Your next question comes from Kelly Botello with CHCH News. Please go ahead.
Hello, this question is also for Dr. Moore on the same topic of that letter that you sent Dr. Hirjean. What are your biggest concerns with those measures that the Niagara Health Unit is implementing and how Dr. Hirjean is managing the return to school?
So the consultation that we had with his office was basically about the public health measures that are in place and the return to school. We want consistent and persistent messaging across Ontario. We have reviewed the science table's recommendations, the importance of the mental, physical, social, and educational needs of our students and the desire to keep them in the classroom as much as possible. And some of the recommendations that he had put in play could have increased the amount of absenteeism of students. So it seemed to go contrary to the recommendations of the science table and our pediatric experts and our education experts. So I just sought clarity from the medical officer of health. I also sought clarity on some of the recommendations and policies that they put in place in a workplace, given that schools are a workplace for teachers and jurisdictionally. Public health physicians typically don't get involved in workplaces. That's more Ministry of Labour. So the purpose of the communication was to seek clarity, to seek ongoing consultation, and to be supportive of our local medical officers of health, which we try to coordinate regular meetings, and this issue had not been brought up with us in the past.
Follow up?
Thank you. And do you think or would you encourage people to dine in at restaurants or work out at gyms when the restrictions do loosen?
So there are safety measures that are in place in all of the restaurants and all of these facilities, including masking, distancing, hand hygiene, and point of visit verification of immunization status. So all of the measures that we've put in place will remain. We do believe a safe and cautious opening at 50% capacity will build confidence in Ontarians and decrease the risk. We think it's proportionate to the risk at present. And as the Premier Premier has said, we need to have a balanced approach that recognizes the importance of someone being able to keep their businesses open, to generate a living, to have a place of employment against the risk of this virus. And I do think it's proportionate and balanced to have them open on the 31st with the measures that we put in place across all these workplaces, which ensure the best safety that we can, given the infectiousness of this virus.
That was Dr. Kieran Moore, our Chief Medical Officer of Health for the province of Ontario, answering some questions from the media this afternoon. And we are going to head to a break. We'll come back to those questions and answers and finish that portion up. And then we'll get to some reaction pieces this afternoon here on Kitchener Today with Brian Burke on City News 570. Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. James Sebastian Scott filling in for Brian. We're going to head back to the province's question and answer portion of their announcement today of the reopening plan set for January 31st. Here is the question and answer portion.
Next question.
Your next question comes from Allison Jones with the Canadian Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, Premier. With businesses that require proof of vaccination set to reopen soon, are you looking at all at updating the requirements for the vaccine certificate to 3 doses from 2?
Not right at this point.
Follow-up?
All right. I'm also wondering about long-term care restrictions. Are you looking at easing any of the visitor restrictions in long-term care?
I'll pass that over to Dr. Moore.
So it would be up to the Ministry of Long-Term Care to make any changes in any of their directions. We consult with them, and any removal of measures that have been put in place would be proportionate and balanced to the risk. The risk still remains relatively high. We clearly are seeing a number of outbreaks across long-term care facilities, both in positivity in workers as well as in their clients and patients, and I think it's prudent to keep those restrictions that are in place until we see significant improvement in the transmissibility and activity of Omicron in our community. So please bear with us. Thank you for the sacrifices you're making. We know these have an effect on the well-being of some individuals in these facilities, but we also need to balance those with the risks of transmission in those facilities. So we review them on a regular basis and ensure that we remove them in a timely and safe fashion, and meet with the Ministry of Long-Term Care on a regular basis with a formal meeting every Friday afternoon to review all measures.
We'll take our final question from the floor.
Mr. Premier, this is a question I've asked whenever there's a trauma. This is a question I've asked a lot of premiers. Right now there's an incident happening in Brampton and Mississauga that is very tragic. First of all, your thoughts, and then how can you reach out to the community that's traumatized right now?
Yeah, they just briefed me literally before I walked in the door. My heart just breaks, you know, for the family and the whole community. What a tragedy it is, and we'll be there. I'll speak to the mayor, Patrick Brown, today, reach out to see if there's anything we can do. But what a loss. It's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, thank you.
And that was a provincial government making an announcement today about easing restrictions in the province at the end of the month. There are some restrictions easing for museums and restaurants of the like, where 50% capacity will be allowable come January 31st for those that require proof of vaccination to be able to have people dine indoors and go to museums and other areas of the province. We'll get into that a little bit after 12:30. We'll have David Marskell coming up from the museum to discuss how this impacts his business, this announcement coming on the 31st, where he's allowed to reopen to some of these restrictions easing. And we'll also talk to Jody Palubisky from the Charcoal Group at 1 o'clock. get his reaction from the restaurant perspective on how this impacts the business. This whole pandemic, these businesses have had to quickly adjust to a lot of these announcements that are being made. And I think it was brought up on Farwell's show earlier this morning where, you have to react quickly to being shut down, but we have a lot of time to be able to react to reopen. So I'm not necessarily certain that we have a lot of time to react to opening on January 31st. It's 11 days, but we'll get that perspective from David Marskell from the museum and from Jody Palubiski to see how they feel about the announcement, because they are directly related to having a big impact on their businesses when it comes to trying to reopen, where they're at with staffing and all that sort of stuff. We'll get into that with those two coming up. The province making that announcement today. We expected something from them towards the end of this week. I thought that something was going to happen tomorrow. That's typically when the provincial government has done these announcements. But a nice surprise to have this out there already on a Thursday and not on a Friday news dump like we've typically seen from this provincial government throughout this pandemic here. So it's nice to know that there was something in the works and that the provincial government didn't wait until a Friday to release that. And we'll also find out tomorrow from our Region Waterloo Public Health Unit what impacts that has on the restrictions easing in the province within our own situation here with COVID in our community. So we'll get into all of that coming up later in the show. And we'll hear from our Region Waterloo Public Health Unit tomorrow when they have a community update. That's all coming up on Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. I'm James Sebastian Scott on City News 570. Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. Filling in for Brian today, James Sebastian Scott in the chair for another day here. And we just heard from the province about easing restrictions within the province. The COVID-19 restrictions that were implemented before Christmas, those are starting to ease with a three-pronged approach that the province is trying to implement here, where it begins on January 31st. And joining me on the show this afternoon is David Marskell, the CEO of the museum. And David, with this announcement, how do you feel about being able to sort of see, again, you'll be able to reopen with some restrictions still in place with capacity limits here?
Hey, James, thanks for having me on. I mean, it's obviously great news. When we shut down, there was some part of me that was relieved. Our policies and safety procedures were working and nobody had COVID at the museum, which was great. And in terms of the safety and the mental well-being of our team and guests, that was certainly important. But now we can plan to reopen in a couple of weeks. And Minister McLeod will be meeting with some of us. She's the minister responsible for culture and sport and other things. So we're meeting at 1 o'clock to learn about more specifics. But we will actually plan to open to 40% capacity for guests coming through. We want people to be safe and we want them to the perception that they are safe, so that we've got a large building, we can distance people out. So we're in a good place. Our Voodoo Lounge will reopen at 50%. Our stores will open, and we're actually going to move our Ronnie Wood store up in Waterloo to free admission through the rest of the show. So we're ready to go and look forward to hosting people for a great cultural experience.
Understanding that, the situation we were in with the Omicron variant and everything like that, and having to, shut your doors to help deal with that situation during probably one of your most recognizable, features that you have at the museum right now. How disappointing was it that you had to do that? But also on the flip side, were you able to get enough people into that exhibit to be able to be okay with that decision from the province when it was made?
Yeah, there's no question that our numbers were growing substantively. We had a lot of people coming through even when we were at 50%. And again, we have a large space, so 50% in terms of whole numbers is fairly significant. And we are time tickets, so we can pulse people through so that they're distanced in groups every 2 hours. And so for them to shut us down, again, balancing safety for all is the most important thing right now. But we have lost momentum, and we've spent a lot of our media dollars. So we need to be creative in rebooting the show and adding some creativity to how we do that to remind people that it's still here. One of the really positive things for me was on the day, I believe it was January 5th, that Premier Ford made the announcement around this time of day that things were shutting in 2 days. We had over 100 sales the next hour that people wanted to get in the building that day. And the next day we had 100 people in addition to the time tickets already sold. So people want to come to the show. And when we reopen and reboot the marketing and communications, I know people will come back and we'll be fine.
Does this give you enough time on January 20th here, talking about this, David, to be able to come up with a good plan to reopen and to get that excitement up again about the exhibit, to welcome more people into the museum, to be able to go through? Do you have enough time to plan out? Because, you know, as I said at the top of the show, a lot of the time these announcements come out, you don't have a lot of time to shut down, but sometimes you don't even have a lot of time to reopen either. So how do you feel about the timing of it all?
Yeah, it's much better this time around that we know we've got 12 days or whatever it is before we reopen. So we're actually meeting later this afternoon to plan for staff and volunteers and all of those things, any supplies that we need and so on. Because as you say, in the past, it's come up that we're opening in 2 days. So that's been more of a challenge. But we do have the luxury of time to plan it and to start to ramp up the awareness again and promotional activity that we need to do. And we are to close on February 27th, but we've been working with the Rolling Stones management and the manager, and she's been extremely helpful. And so I'm optimistic that we will be able to extend the show. We'll know that in a couple of weeks, exactly any details around that. But we've got time to plan, and we've got a great show. So I do believe that people will come back.
When it comes to communicating all these changes to your staff and being able to keep them up to date on when they can return to work and have the measures in place to be able to keep everyone safe within the museum, how has that communication been, perceived by your staff to be able to, you know, start ramping up again and coming back to work and doing what they do?
Well, it's very important to me of the mindset and the mental well-being of our team. So we are in close contact. We have weekly meetings. We had a meeting this morning. This afternoon, we are having an online music bingo game with our entire team. So just trying to stay connected and keep them in a positive frame. We've kept everybody on payroll. We didn't know how long that was going to last, so I'm also glad that we're going to be opening sooner than later on that. But it was important to me that people didn't worry about not paying their rent or whatever bills and financial needs they have. So the team is the most important, and we filter that along with our service to the community and the bottom line of the organization. So those three things are what I filter decisions through for closing or opening or whatever. So I think the team's in a good place. I'm just really happy and pleased that nobody got ill prior to the closing, because I was fearful if one person got it, it could have spread quite quickly. So I'm glad everybody remained safe.
When it comes to the decision that you made, David, about the 40% capacity, even though you can open up to 50%, is that more so just to make sure that there's enough space within the museum to be able to really enjoy the exhibit as best as people can, given that they're on, you know, a set time to be able to go through everything? Is that more so behind that decision?
Actually, the people can stay in the building as long as they want. I'm sorry if I misled you on that. The 2 hour time window is, if you book a ticket for 10 a.m., for example, it's valid from 10 until noon to enter. You can stay as long as you like. But what we're finding is people are staying a long time. They're staying 90 minutes or longer because it's a big, big show over five floors. And people are really taking the time to go through it and read some of the you know, the notes or see some of the videos and enjoy the guitars and the costumes and so on. So the 40% is really for safety and the perception of safety. And as I say, we can pulse people through. And we've gotten very sophisticated. We know at 10 o'clock the majority of people come, and we know in 40 minutes they'll be at this stage in the building, and then at the hour point they'll be, the majority of them have moved on to here. So we want to, if they move through together, we want to make sure that they're spaced out still. So hence the 40% decision, just to give them that space and that perception of safety.
When it comes to some of these conversations that you will have to have with the province about, you know, planning for the reopening and everything, like, I know you said, you mentioned there's a meeting this afternoon. Will anything when it comes to rapid antigen tests come up about receiving some of those for your staff and being able to, you know, hand out some of that stuff and get some PPE, or is that all, you know, on your cost that you have to provide that on?
We had enjoyed some supplies from the region, but in most cases, it's very difficult to get the testing and so on. We do have some tests left, and we're following the lead of the province. We had been asking staff to test every Monday, but now we're saying if you have any symptoms, just do not come in, test at home, and wait it out. To me, that makes the most sense, considering we don't have a lot. We have a finite number of rapid tests to deploy. All of our staff, all of our board, all of our volunteers are 100% vaccinated. So that gives me another comfort level that should they get sick, it will not be as serious as it could be.
All right, David, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today and giving us your perspective on this announcement here today. Appreciate you doing that.
Thank you very much. We'll see everybody at Unzipped at the museum.
Take care, David. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was David Marskell, the CEO of the museum, just reacting to what he is sort of dealing with this announcement now. You know, he does appreciate that in 11 days he's allowed to open, and he's given enough time to be able to react to this announcement. He mentioned that in some cases in previous announcements, he's had 2 days to reopen, which has created a little bit of a complication and issue with trying to get everything sorted out on that end. So, you know, I think the government has given us enough notice and time to be able to, you know, reopen some of these places that have had restrictions made upon them. We'll find out from the restaurant industry whether or not, from Jody Palubiski, if he feels like there's enough time. That's coming up at 1 o'clock. On the show to reopen some of his restaurants. But David mentioned that, you know, he does feel fairly certain that, you know, at the 40% capacity that he mentioned, that he can get, you know, some people to come back to the museum and enjoy the Unzipped exhibit. That was a big exhibit for them to be shut down in the middle of a pandemic, to not have people go through there. So just reacting to that announcement from the province was David Marskell. And, you know, this is something that I think every small business who runs a restaurant or runs a museum or anything of that nature that requires people to, you know, come to the restaurants or museums or anything like that, was hoping that an announcement like this was coming. And, you know, Premier Ford did mention that something at the end of the week was going to come. That was today. And this is where we're at. So a three-pronged approach to reopening, and it starts on January 31st. So we'll see how all that works out, and we'll get reaction from you, the caller, for whatever comments that you want to make coming up after this break. We're going to head to that, and then we'll come back with your calls. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. James Sebastian Scott filling in for Brian.
We will actually plan to open to 40% capacity for guests coming through. We're in a good place. Our Voodoo Lounge will reopen 50%. Our stores will open, and we're actually going to move our Ronnie Wood store up in Waterloo to free admission through the rest of the show. So we're ready to go and look forward to hosting people for a great cultural experience.
That was David Marskell, the CEO of the museum, joining us this afternoon to react to Premier Ford's announcement of the reopening plan that was just announced today from January 31st. It's interesting, some of the commentary I'm seeing on social media about this reopening plan. One tweet I wanted to read was from Joe Warmington, actually, from the Toronto Sun. He says, I keep hearing about Ford's loosening restrictions, but what I heard was actually a five-day extension to January 31st from the original January 26th plans on lockdown, then gradual opening up by March if they don't find a new variant or reason. And he's asking people, what did they hear? So it's certainly interesting from Joe. I think that that's not a surprise that we're seeing people say that there's a five-day extension on the lockdown. You can certainly take it that way. I think that's something from the last announcement that if we remember what was originally announced was that it was supposed to be revisited by January 26th. So you could take it as a five-day extension on the lockdown, and certainly some people are reacting to it that way. Some other reactions too about, you know, saying the UK has opened up and we're still in this endless loop of lockdowns, and you know, we're kind of at the mercy a little bit with the government here about what they are announcing and doing. You know, we can certainly look at other parts of the world on what they're doing when it comes to reopening things. You know, we're kind of having to follow the announcements from this provincial government. I just wanted to go through some of the other stuff that is allowed to, reopen as well. Social gatherings increasing to 10 people indoors and 25 people outdoors. Capacity limits increasing to 50%, like we mentioned, for restaurants, bars, retailers, shopping malls, gyms, cinemas, meeting and event spaces, recreational amenities, museums and attractions, casinos, bingo halls, religious services and rites and ceremonies, arenas, theaters and concert venues capped at 500 people or 50% capacity, whichever is less. And proof of vaccination is still required at certain settings. Then February 21st is when the next phase of this three-pronged plan will take effect. Social gatherings increase to 25 people on February 21st indoors and 100 people outdoors. So that's kind of where we're at here when it comes to this three-pronged approach here. January 31st, we'll start reopening some things. February 21st is in the second phase. And then by March 14th, further easing of restrictions would be implemented. Capacity limits in all indoor public settings, proof of vaccination to stay in existing settings come March 14th, lifting remaining capacity limits on religious services, rites, or ceremonies, and increasing social gathering limits to 50 people indoors with no limits for outdoor gatherings. So that's what the provincial government announced today when it comes to how we are approaching, coming out of this Omicron wave here. Certainly an interesting comments that I'm seeing on social media about this phased approach that the government has announced here today. I go back to a lot of people being critical of this government by extending that, revisiting from the January 26th to the 31st. A lot of people are commenting about how that should have been something that they were a little more honest and open about when it came to the last announcement that was made on this. But I think that for our community, it is a good thing that we are seeing some stuff starting to reopen, obviously, because we want to make sure that our economy opens back up again and we can start safely doing some stuff once again. So that is the latest from the provincial government today. And we'll speak with Jody Paliubisky coming up at 1 o'clock here when it comes to how the restaurants are affected by this. So, a lot of restaurants, they've had to pivot just like any other business through not just our region, but the province to try and keep up with all the restrictions, capacity limits, everything like that, and see what they had to do to make ends meet through the pandemic. And this is just another pivot that they have to do. I don't want to overuse that word, but that's, it seems like that's another thing that they would have to, get ready for. And you know, we talked about the supply shortages yesterday on the show, about how some grocery stores are having issues getting product. I wonder if that's the same issue that the restaurants are running into, if they're going to be ready to go with product come the 31st when they have to reopen to, when they can reopen to more people coming into the restaurants and that sort of thing. And you know, they haven't been closed down through this lockdown because you've been able to do curbside pickup and stuff like that. But obviously they're going to have to order more food and stuff like that to be able to accommodate the increase in business that they might see. So it'll be interesting to see how we get a reaction from the restaurant industry on that and how they feel about it, because we certainly, you know, heard from David Marskell there that he is going to be ready to go. I'm going to be roaring back and trying to get people through the exhibit that he has, the unzipped exhibit, and see, you know, if they can extend that even. He mentioned he's working with the Rolling Stones management to try and extend that, to try and get, you know, more out of it, given that there was a lockdown implemented in the middle of it. But, you know, from everything that that I hear from David, he's optimistic about things and hoping that he can get the length of the exhibit that he had originally planned for. And that's certainly something that that I think every business is looking forward to try and get back on their feet and be able to, you know, welcome people back in safely and do those things once again, like we were doing before this Omicron wave kind of took over and we were shut down once again. So it's the feedback definitely coming in from this government is interesting. Dr. Moore is trending on Twitter right now. And, you know, a lot of people are being critical of this government for, you know, what they just announced. And, you know, that's something that I think we come to expect every announcement that we hear. Positive news from the government saying that, you know, these are things that that we have to do and we just have to kind of react to it. But, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a mixed reaction to it as well on social media. I know NDP leader Andrea Horvath blasting the Ford government for not having a plan to begin surgeries again. Thousands, including cancer surgeries, have been postponed. That's coming from our Cynthia Mulligan from City TV. Health Minister indicated it could be mid-February before those surgeries can resume. So Andrea Horvath being critical of the Ford government about their reopening plan as well. She's saying, you know, they're calling, the NDP are calling on the government to implement paid sick days for people who do have to go back to work. That's something that Andrea Horvath has been trying to push forward for a long time. She's saying that reopening must come with paid sick days, expanded certificate programs, that sort of thing. The Green Party of Ontario, Mike Schreiner, also calling for 10 permanent paid sick days as the reopening plan was announced. We didn't hear any of that from the provincial government, so it's not a surprise that we're seeing his opposition calling for those paid sick days to be able to help when it comes to staff who might have to be off work for a period of time if they do become infected with the virus. But that's certainly something that was left out of the announcement that the opposition leaders were hoping to hear from the provincial government today, and we didn't. We did hear the three-pronged approach that they're taking, but we didn't hear anything about those paid sick days that most opposition from Ford has been calling on him to do since the start of this pandemic, and it hasn't been implemented just yet. So we will see. We'll see if that pressure from the Ford opposition leaders will pressure the Ford government to implement some of those paid sick days. I certainly don't think it will, because we haven't seen him being pressured into doing that yet. So we'll see where it goes. But we will have Jody Pagliabisci coming up with us to react to this announcement from the restaurant perspective. And then that's coming up right after 1 o'clock news. When we do go to the 1 o'clock news, we will be hearing more about the provincial three-pronged opening plan with our Paul McPhee. So we will go to the news and then we'll come back with Jody Pagliabisci. This is City News 570. Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke, James Sebastian Scott, filling in for Brian. And we've heard from the province today about their easing restriction announcement that they've had today, a three-pronged approach starting on January 31st. And joining me right now on the line to give us the restaurant perspective on this announcement is Jody Palibisky, the CEO of Charcoal Group. Good afternoon, Jody.
How are you today? Thanks for having me.
I'm good, thank you. No problem. So, Jody, when it comes to the announcement that was made today, what initially do you feel, when it comes to what Premier Ford and the Minister of Health announced today?
Well, obviously, any chance to have an opportunity to start opening back up and getting people back to work is a great opportunity. It's funny what suffices for positive news. Really, what he did today was extend the lockdown by 5 days beyond where we were. We had really been hoping that we would have an opportunity to open on Wednesday. Having extended to Monday is not great because I think days matter for these people that have been out of work for an extensive amount of time over the last 22 months. And that said, knowing that we can open Monday, knowing that we have some time to plan and kind of recommission the businesses is certainly welcome overall.
I'm glad you mentioned that 5 days there, because I did see some of that reaction coming in initially when the province announced the 31st as the date to open up. On social media, I did see some people just saying, wait, I thought, we revisit this on the 26th. So you mentioned that days matter. So for you, when it comes to planning for the 26th versus the 31st, how do those 5 days really impact you, I suppose?
Well, it's a lot of the same pieces. It's moved out a little bit further. We have all schedules posted for all staff across the board. So schedules are going out today for staff to be in next Wednesday, as an example. And so staff had already been talked about, and we had obviously framed it up as being very tentative depending on announcements, et cetera. But you're always thinking at least a week out for these kinds of things. And, of course, the plans are about staffing, scheduling, ordering, prepping, and doing all of those activities that in each restaurant can mean up to, up to 80, 90, 100 staff at sometimes, and trying to get everybody mobilized and things back up and running and make sure products are fresh and coming in your back door, as well as even service providers. All of these things extend well beyond just the faces you see when you walk into a restaurant. There are suppliers, there are service providers, there are R&M people. I mean, all of those things, all of those people all down the chain are affected.
Do you feel like when it comes to being able to open on the 31st that one, you have enough time to be able to get all that product back into your restaurant to help with the influx of business, but also do you hope that you're not faced with any delays on getting stuff to you, given that there's supply chain issues right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a concern. Of course, having this amount of days, it's 11 days to prepare, is more than we've had at any other time. So in a lot of ways, that's welcome. As you certainly know, coming out of past lockdowns over the last 2 years, often it's been with 3 days notice or 4 days notice or sometimes even less. So having this amount of days gives us a great deal of confidence that we're going to be able to ramp up effectively. And our supply chain is, overall, yes, there has been difficulties, and they're certainly running, and it's a lot of effort for them to try and deliver on their promises, but they've done an overall great job, and so we're very fortunate to have some great supplier partners.
When it came to, I suppose, what your hopes were from knowing that the province was going to announce something this week, did you think that it was going to be in kind of a three-pronged plan like we are seeing right now, or did you hope you'd be able to kind of ramp up a little bit quicker than what the province has laid out today?
You try to game this out to certain degrees, so you're prepared for a lot of different things. I was fully expecting that this 50% capacity would be a big part of it. In a lot of ways, that's not a bad thing. There's still several people. Obviously, the Omicron virus is still very, very relevant in our communities, and we want our team to feel very confident that if they're concerned at all, they can stay home. Sick calls are certainly on the increase with some of the slightest symptoms. We're encouraging people to stay at home and rest. And so at 50% capacity, it really takes a little bit of the heat off of managers, of staff, and lets everyone know to take care of themselves and we'll get back up. So the 50%, I think, is a great thing. Some of the pieces that still aren't clear, and hopefully they come later, as you may or may not know, before we were locked down completely at the beginning of January, they had put in restrictive hours of operation. So we don't know if that's the case. Will the last call be at 10 o'clock, or will we have regular hours of operation? Because that will affect number of staff coming back and the way you staff for shifts, et cetera. And so there's still quite a few unknowns. The three-prong attack and anything we can do to have a little bit of an idea of what the government might be thinking and how to come out of this is always welcome as well. So yeah, I find it interesting. But generally what happens is they make these types of speeches and then you wait for the details to follow.
Is there any sort of follow-up from you or any other a person that you work with within the industry to have a conversation with the province on some of these things that are still kind of left blurred with the lines a little bit? Or are you just kind of trying to get everything as best as you can up to speed and then you'll kind of deal with that a little bit later? What's kind of the feeling, I guess, within your company when it comes to that?
We tend to try and learn from each time, try to iterate. Largely, we depend on ourselves and we share a lot of information back and forth. We kind of joke that over the last 2 years, there's been a greater level of co-opetition between operators. I've talked to more of the local restaurateurs than probably would have previously, sharing ideas, sharing resources, sharing information, what you're hearing, what we're hearing. So that's certainly going on a whole lot more. I think Restaurants Canada have done a better job communicating to us, communicating to the province. That said, I'm not sure any of it really moves the needle when it comes down to their decision-making or their policies. At the end of the day, we just wait to hear it like everybody else, and it's always a bit of a crapshoot as to what's going to come out.
As far as your staff goes, when it comes to returning to work and ramping up again, what's been the feeling amongst them when it comes to whatever questions they might have or returning to work with a percentage capacity of people coming into the restaurants and eating indoors? Has there been any sort of feedback that you've received from your staff yet on this announcement?
No, I haven't today as of yet. Certainly all the managers are talking and sharing plans and discussing about timelines, et cetera. We call our staff every single week at a minimum. We've been trying to do various things to ensure that the communication and the lines of communication are open. And generally speaking, as I think about it, I know the effect of the last lockdown. There was tears. There were people that were very upset, very concerned, very nervous about being out of work yet again. So I can only imagine that this is very, very welcome news to the masses.
When it comes to the three-pronged approach that we talked about, knowing kind of getting an idea of what the province is planning for the February easing of restrictions and then the March, does that help you, have an idea of where to go as you approach that date instead of kind of being left for another announcement to come or anything like that? Like, I think this is the first time we've actually been able to see a little bit further into, the next couple of months on what the government's planning on doing.
It certainly does. And I'll tell you the other actions that really help a lot of the municipalities and the things that they're doing to get ahead of the game are really helping as well. We see, the local governments, Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge have been, last year, amongst the nine municipalities that we currently operate, they were the first to approve expanded patios once again, which take a great deal of planning for staffing and in some cases construction and building and supplies. And so this year already they've jumped on it. Cambridge has already confirmed as of March 15th, expanded patios will be in place. So to have the municipalities jump out and give you that kind of support and an opportunity to plan is really, really welcome and helpful.
I know this. This isn't probably the ramp up back to where you once were before the pandemic. But are you hopeful that the business is going to pick up again in this next few, at least towards the end of the month, going into February and back into March as the weather warms up a little bit? That you're hopeful that business will start kind of getting back to how it was.
100%. I'm absolutely optimistic about the future. Every chance we've had to open up, the communities, our guests, our team members have been out in droves supporting us. We've been thrilled with the level of business that we've had when we've been able to deliver it. And so I'm very optimistic about spring and summer 22 and where we're headed from here.
And I'm assuming that you'll take full advantage of the expanded patios again this season, eh?
Absolutely. That's been a real focus for us over the last 2 weeks, speaking with municipalities, planning, already starting to order supplies, creating applications and job recruitment ads to try and looking at our staffing as we gear up for what we think is going to be our busiest summer ever. I think we're very optimistic about the expanded patios. That's been a huge, huge win.
Jody, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I appreciate you doing that.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. That was Jody Palubisky, the CEO of the Charcoal Group, with his thoughts on this announcement today. And a little bit different a reaction from the restaurant industry versus the museum industry. I think we kind of expected that. The restaurant industry, tends to, approach these announcements with a little bit more of, trying to answer all the uncertain questions that they might have when it comes to dining in and all those sorts of things. But I think generally that I got the sense that Jody is optimistic about being able to ramp up the business. The extended patio stuff that he mentioned certainly will help when it comes to that and being able to have people outdoors again with more patio space than what a restaurant might have on a normal occasion. And that's certainly something that has helped restaurants throughout this pandemic. He did mention the supply chain shortages that they'll still have to deal with, but the 11 days, I think the sense that I'm getting from everyone that we are speaking to so far about this is that it's the first time that we've had one of these announcements with so much time to plan, and I think that's kind of been appreciated. Jody did mention the 5-day extension of the lockdown, echoing the same concerns that Jill Warmington had when it came to this announcement, and that's certainly something that Jody mentioned the timeline of the 5 days to be able to open on the Wednesday on the 26th versus the Monday of the 31st does create a little bit of more uncertainty when it comes to being able to get more people into a building on the 26th versus the 31st. So some general optimism with some still unanswered questions left. And I think that's kind of normal when it comes to these announcements. I think that it kind of takes a couple of days for operators and restaurant owners and all that to sort out the blurred out blurring the lines things that they still have to answer and that Jody mentioned as well. So we'll see if Jody gets those answers that he's looking for, and reaching out to other operators as well certainly has helped him in the past. So that's something that sharing information is probably the one thing that has made this easier than not on those restaurant operators. So we'll head to a break. We'll come back right after this. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke, James Sebastian Scott filling in on Sydney News 570.
Having this amount of days, it's 11 days to prepare, is more than we've had at any other time. And our supply chain is, overall, yes, there has been difficulties, and they're certainly running, and it's a lot of effort for them to try and deliver on their promises. But they've done an overall great job, and so we're very fortunate to have some great supplier partners.
That was Jody Palubisky, the CEO of the Charcoal Group, with his reaction to the provincial government's announcement today of easing restrictions. That's going to come in a three-pronged approach starting on January 31st, where restrictions will be eased, and then further restrictions eased on the 21st of February, and then more restrictions easing on March 14th. So something that the provincial government hasn't really done, gave us a little bit of a look into their crystal ball as best as they can, I suppose, when it comes to what they are planning to do when it comes to reopening some of the restrictions and easing those. That begins on January 31st. We got Tom on the phone. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you, Tom?
They asked him a question, what are you going to do to help those small businesses? And then he went on and said, well, you know, we are going to be stronger, this, so nothing was there. He gets blamed, everybody else except himself. He's fired 2,600 nurses. What they did to the old age homes when they didn't, this was forged. They left him there for 3-4 days without food or anything. And the only thing, like, you can predict that you're going to open there and there, but we don't know where this variance is going. And right now the number one thing is, but they won't do. They won't hire all these other nurses or all these other people. He's fighting with the medical staff. Doesn't want to give him sick days, so... I don't know, like, we're not asking the right questions, but I mean, it all going to depend on the COVID.
Yeah, and you can plan all you want, right, Tom? But when it comes down to it, you know, you can't predict how the variants are going to evolve, or if there's going to be more. You know, you can only plan for what's kind of ahead of us in the next, you know, at least 11 days. We know that restrictions are going to ease at some point, but you know, it's hard to look into that crystal ball and say, oh, you know, March we're going to be exactly on target for the third step, right?
And, you know, like, people ask, well, when is this going to be normal? I mean, stupidest question ever. It doesn't depend. Nobody has a crystal ball. This is a lot bigger than what we've ever experienced in our lifetime. So I think the priority should be how to work with all federal governments, with all our provinces, how to subside this. This is the best part. But, you know, everybody's juggling for political points. So.
Yeah, Tom, okay. Point well taken. Thanks so much for the call and sharing, you know, some of your thoughts on that. It's hard to plan for what's next, right? And those are things that we are, you know, trying to anticipate when it comes to some of these announcements. And, you know, we can plan for what's going to happen in February and in March, like Tom mentioned. But that doesn't mean that we're going to be right on track for those things, because we just don't know how the situation is going to evolve in this pandemic. And, you know, that's maybe why we haven't seen the province come out and say, you know, this is what we expect to have in this month or that month or anything like that. But this is the first time we've ever seen the province really plan kind of 2 months ahead of time. So it'll be interesting to see on those dates if we are on target with what the province is planning, or if things will change. I certainly do hope that, you know, when it comes to this, we don't have to go back into any sort of lockdown. And I think people in general don't want to do that again, right? And you know, we'll have to leave that to the government officials, because they're the ones that are making those decisions. You can point all you want to what's happening around the world. That is up to our government officials to make those decisions. So I think that's kind of where we're at right now. Tom mentioned that, you know, you can plan all you want. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. But we have Sarah on the line this afternoon. Sarah, good afternoon.
Hi, I'm just calling in as I'm fed up with the government easing up restrictions and then putting us back into lockdowns and doing everything that they're doing, but not fixing our hospital system.
Yeah, Sarah, that's a point well taken. Tom mentioned that too, right? And when it came to, you know, there are nurses that are waiting to get approval to work in our hospitals, and the government has dragged their feet on that, right?
And not only that, they have gotten rid of staff. There's an easy way to fix it. Like I've been saying all the way along since the beginning, is close down a couple of hospitals, say 4 or 5 small hospitals, maybe one's in Cambridge. Like we have one in Cambridge, we have one in we have Grand Valley, we have Mary's. So take one of our hospitals, close it down, and keep it as a COVID-only hospital. So if you have COVID, you have to go to that hospital. So if you're downtown Toronto and you need to get your cancer treatment or you need to get your heart operation, you can still do it, because those hospitals will be open with no COVID patients. all the COVID patients are to be flown or driven into one of the COVID hospitals. So if you have one like in maybe King City, one maybe like in Georgetown, one maybe on another part of the outskirts of Toronto, one in Ottawa, one in Northern Ontario, then I think you can have a pretty good fix there.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah, for the call. I don't know if that is a solution that the government even thought of or is ever planned for. I don't know if closing down a hospital, though, would be the right solution and only having COVID patients go to that one hospital. But, you know, we have to be creative with some of these fixes that we have to come up with during a pandemic, because last time I checked, there's no playbook for it. Right. And I think when it comes to all of this, we're just trying to do the best that we can as humans to react to whatever is announced from the government. So we'll see if we're going to be on target with any of these dates that the government gave out today. But we'll head to the news and then we'll come back with more of Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. I'm James Sebastian Scott on City News 570.
Pillow talk. Another night of hearing myself talk.
Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. James Sebastian Scott filling in for Brian. And right now we're heading into a conversation about the EQAO testing and the Waterloo Region District School Board on Monday night, unanimously passed writing a letter to the province about hoping that they can come up with a plan to pause the EQAO testing with students for another year, citing stress the exams would place on students and teachers during an already difficult year. And we're going to have a conversation with Kelly Gallagher McKay. She's an assistant professor of and program coordinator at Law and Society at Wilfrid Laurier University, and also studies educational inequality at Laurier. And we say good afternoon to Kelly right now. Kelly, good afternoon.
Hi, James.
Thanks for joining me today. So, Kelly, from your perspective of studying educational inequality, when it comes to the school board asking for a pause on this, what are your general thoughts first when it comes to the issues that they bring up as students have to face when it comes to these tests?
Well, I really have mixed feelings about this request. I think that students are stressed. There's no question that anxiety and depression has gone up over the pandemic. I also think that we might sometimes be more dramatic about the pressure involved in testing than we really should. I know there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical of standardized tests. They sometimes seem to just tell us what we already know, or they the information has been misused by groups like the Fraser Institute to rank schools. Sometimes it seems like it puts certain groups of students at a disadvantage if outcomes don't work the way we want. But at the same time, we also do need system-wide data. And I think there is a point to having an idea how kids are doing relative with the provincial picture in mind. And in particular with the pandemic, where there's a very genuine and real concern that students may have learned less at this point than they would have in other years. The fact we don't have representative, comparable education data in Ontario may have led to us paying less attention to the harms happening to students educationally than we paid to other things. The saying, what's measured matters, has some truth to it in public policy. And I think we've paid not nearly enough attention to the educational harms that have been associated with trying to cope with the pandemic.
Kelly, you mentioned the data that gets collected from these tests, and there's going to be obviously a gap with not having these tests last year, and if there's a potential of pausing them again this year, that's a 2-year gap.
This will be a 3-year gap. They actually froze them in 2020. They did very selective, voluntary testing, just a small subsection of the population, not representative last year. And if they were to hold it again, we'd have a 3-year gap. And normally I'd be really worried about it, because the probably the most important thing that you do with this data, or one of them, is to sort of track trends over time. But the thing is, when the new government came in, EQAO made a surprising decision to change the assessments, which means it wouldn't have been that comparable to what came before anyway. And so, weirdly enough, I think EQAO is not popular from a lefty perspective. Educators don't like it. They feel like it's given undue weight. But it has also been an important asset in equality struggles. It's been used a lot by racialized communities to point to systematic injustice. So a three-year gap in EQAO data does raise the question of, like, is there some other way we could be collecting system-wide data? I think we need data. I'm not sure at this point EQAO is the right solution, because we wouldn't be able to really compare what got collected this year with earlier years anyway. So it's a big, big question. I certainly understand what the board was doing, but then my question back to the board is, well, what are you going to be able to tell us about how students are doing overall and where students need more help? Because I think we do need to be advocating for extra investments to make sure that kids who have fallen off track over the last few years, and we all the international data where people have managed to write tests and still be okay says kids have fallen behind. Where are those kids in Ontario, and are we getting them the supports they need and their teachers the supports they need to be able to really look out for students and make sure these short-term harms aren't long-term harms?
Kelly, I know that you have to run right away, but I just wanted to ask you if there's a better way to collect data than having these tests within the schools, or if there's a chance that we could potentially digitize these tests or something like that, where these assessments could still take place.
They're looking at new testing technology, and that we have improved how we can deliver tests over time. So that's sort of underway. I think there are two obvious alternatives to doing a province-wide census test. One is representative sampling, and we use that for all sorts of things. So where you've really consciously gone out and figured out what is the right cross-section of students in Ontario, that's been advocated for a long time by groups like the Ontario Principals Council, that we should give up the census, not test every kid, but test a representative sample. The other is to use teacher-controlled assessments, which are used to diagnose students' reading, diagnose being a sort of fake medical word, I guess, but that really are normed, that give us a good idea how people are doing relative to grade level. We could aggregate up those teacher-administered assessments and produce a picture of how students are doing overall. And I think we do need to look hard at the question of how we know how students are doing relative to other years in Ontario, because there, I believe, is an urgent need to be addressing educational harms from the pandemic. So I think there's a point to data. I don't know if EQAO would have solved anything, and I certainly understand why the board did what they did.
Kelly, thanks so much for taking the time to discuss this with us today. I appreciate you joining us on the program.
My pleasure, James. Thanks for calling.
Take care. That was
bye-bye.
Kelly Gallagher McKay, who studies educational inequality at Wilfrid Laurier University. She's also a assistant professor and program coordinator of law and society at Laurier, and mentions that we do need this data. So that 3-year gap that she mentioned is a point well taken. And, the first year that it was sort of fizzled out, she mentioned that, only a brief sample was taken and then it got canceled altogether. So this would be the third year, of us not having these EQAO tests in schools to get that data. So it does provide a little bit of a gap of the data, and trying to come up with solutions to be able to still collect some of that data through other means necessary. But that is work underway and doesn't help us now when it comes to these things. But I know that the Waterloo Region District School Board isn't the only school board that wanted to, make this test kind of be canceled for another year. I do believe that it was the Wellington Dufferin-Guelph area that had a same request into the school board as well to put this on delay for another year, citing the same concerns that our region school board had, the public school board, when it comes to that. So, you know, I think it's an interesting conversation. I do think that we, like Kelly mentioned, we do need the data. We do need to see where the students are at when it comes to these tests and where they're at with their educational needs and all those sorts of things. Her mentioning that some of that data sometimes is unfairly used to rank schools. I certainly agree with that, you know, we don't want to start getting into this school in this region is way better than that school in Cambridge or anything like that. So it does provide some data that could be used against students and where they're at, but I think it's a measurement for where we can see our students going when it comes to their educational needs and learning. I'll be honest with you, I had to take the EQAO test when I moved here from Manitoba as a student. I moved here through high school, and I was kind of surprised that I had to take a test like that, because to me, I thought, you know, what I do in school was equivalent to what that test was, right? And Kelly did mention that it's something that people feel like we're already kind of doing when we go to school, but it's another tool for us to use for data, right? And you know, try explaining that to a teenager in high school who has to do another test, right? And I get it. I wasn't doing it in the middle of a pandemic, but it was a little surprising that I had to do that test. And now that I look back on it, you know, it gave me a good idea on where I was at when it comes to my educational needs. And trust me, if I took that test when I was in grade 8 versus grade 10 or 11 when I had to take the test, the results probably would have been different, because my focus in school was a little bit different in comparing those grades together. We have Doug on the phone. Good afternoon, Doug.
James, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
You're doing well. Before I make a comment, I didn't want to say something. I listened to you from the very first day that you started on this station, and I've listened to you, and I've heard everything, the way you talk, that you've grown, and I gather you moved up the ladder a little bit in staff, but I'm thoroughly impressed with the way you have you've grown into your job and your position. And something, unfortunately, no one knows what I do in my job, but yours is like right there in the public eye. So you've done extremely well, and you're doing a great job filling in for Ryan too. So
thanks, Doug. I appreciate that.
Anyway, on the possibility that what was old is new again, because of the fact that they're facing staff shortages, there's problems. When I was in school, I can remember that at least two different subjects, maybe three, each teacher had a selection of modules that they assigned for the students to do, and they did them at their own speed. So if a person was really struggling, as the teacher checks how the progress is going, it's going to be obvious without them opening your mouth or doing a thing. It also provides a grip on how they're progressing in terms of what they're learning. And I distinctly remember, there's no pressure. There's it's not a race. It's not, whoever finishes first, you know, get some kind of gold star or something. It was something that the students were given an opportunity to learn more, to progress at their own terms and their own speed. And I think this might ease some of the pressure on both the students and the teachers in terms of where we're at right now.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for the call. I appreciate your thoughts on that. Those are some things that we have to consider too, right? The pressure the students are facing, the pressure that the educators are facing, trying to teach in a pandemic, and whether they're going to have people in class or virtually or any of that nature. Like I said, when I took that test when I was a student, I didn't have to deal with those things that we're dealing with in the pandemic, right? So it's easy for me to say, hey, like, I didn't expect that I had to take this test, but, you know, whatever, what's another test for me, right? But for students nowadays who are dealing with the pressures of the pandemic, it could be more stressful than it ever was for students to do that. We certainly can't judge how people feel about having to take another test that they weren't expecting to have to take or anything of that nature. And I don't know if the right answer is completely canceling these again, because it is useful data, like Kelly mentioned. But at the same time, we have to consider everything when it comes to how our students are feeling, how the educators are feeling, how even the policymakers are feeling about this. So it'll be interesting to see what EQAO does when it comes to this. We have Kyle on the phone. Kyle, good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon there, James. I think you and I are the same vintage, or around the same vintage, but I don't know about you, but I hated the EQAO test when I was in high school. It was so much pressure. I mean, my parents, they hired tutors for me and all that stuff, and I hated it, and I don't understand. I get it, but it feels like when you're doing the EQAO test, you're kind of dividing the students at the same time, are you not?
Well, and that's what that's what Kelly mentioned, right? She mentioned that the data could be used against some of those students who do take the test, and whether that's right or wrong, like that, you know, we shouldn't be using data like that when it comes to some of those think tanks that use it to rank schools. Like, to me, that's an overreach or an overuse of the data. But at the same time, we need to understand where the students are at when it comes to their comprehension of things, so we can fix some of the educational needs that they might have, right? So it's kind of a catch-22 a little bit, in the sense that we do need the data, but sometimes it gets unfairly used against us, right?
Right, and it's the same thing with like the whole applied and academic and all that stuff, that side of high school too, right? Because I was in applied, right? And I remember the pressures of you should be an academic, you got to go to university and stuff, and that's where I look at it, because I, like I said, I suck at tests, I hate it, I think there's, I get so flustered and nervous on it. So I'm kind of looking at those students that are kind of like me, right? So I just wanted my 2 cents on there. Thanks, bud.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. Appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And I'm the same way, right? Like, I hate a test. I could be the best student possible when it comes to doing the work. But when I got to, you know, hey, guys, you can't talk to one another. You got to do the test yourself. You can't share information, none of that. That's where the pressure comes from, right? And you're trying to, you can study all you want. I would go blank on tests. I could study till I'm blue in the face and say, yes, I understand the concepts of everything. I get to the test and it, like, it never existed. I'm not someone who has a photographic memory. I knew people who were like that, who would look at a page and be able to remember everything off of that page. Not this guy. And when it came to writing the tests, man, oh man, I wish I had that photographic memory, because it would have helped me so much when it came to taking those tests. Does motivation play a part of that into why I suck at tests? Yes, of course. I was not a motivated student when I was a little bit younger. I was more motivated in my high school years because I wanted probably to do something with my life. That's probably something that my parents were pushing me to do. But at the same time, I always sucked at tests, even when I pulled my socks up in school, in high school, and tried to be a better student. And the EQAO test, when I got here and found out about it, I was like, man, I didn't have to do this in Manitoba. Who moved me here? So I'll blame my parents for making me have to do the EQAO test. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. We'll head to a break and we'll come back. If you have more thoughts on the EQAO test, our region's school board wrote a letter to the ministry wanting it to be canceled for another year. And we'll get some more thoughts on that coming up right after this. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke, James Sebastian Scott filling in on City News 570.
I think EQAO is not popular from a lefty perspective. Educators don't like it. They feel like it's given undue weight. But it has also been an important asset in equality struggles. It's been used a lot by racialized communities to point to systematic injustice.
That was Kelly Gallagher McKay from the Wilfrid Laurier University, rather. She studies educational inequality, and she mentioned some of the benefits of having these EQAO tests. And, she mentions that it's not popular amongst the lefties, but it's not, I don't think it's popular amongst any student that wants to take it either. I was one of those students at one point, and I didn't like it. But you kind of have to do what you have to do in school to get through it and get your grades and all that sort of thing. The data, definitely useful. It definitely shows it, you know, where students lay when it comes to when it comes to where they are at with their educational needs and that sort of thing. And I think that's where, you know, it's useful. And you know, Kelly mentioned that it's used by racialized communities to be able to, take care of some of the injustices that they may face when it comes to the education system and that sort of thing as well. So it's definitely a useful tool to be able to deal with some of those issues. But having a gap like we have right now with not really doing this over the course of 2 to 3 years, it definitely creates a little bit of a disconnect when it comes to where students were 3 years ago to where they are now. And I think education evolves since then. We certainly have seen that the pandemic has had stressors on education system throughout this whole ordeal. And I just don't know what the right answer is. And Minister Lecce, the Minister of Education, he has not been very committed to providing an answer on what they're going to do when it comes to this. Are they going to digitize it? Are they going to cancel it? Are they going to be able to figure out if canceling it is going to be the right solution altogether? He hasn't really said what the plan is. And I think, you know, that kind of leaves school boards to try and do what our region's school board wanted to do by writing their letter to the ministry and talking about it on that call that happened. All the board members unanimously approved it to be able to write the letter to the province and bring it up to them on a call. And we're sort of left with, seeing where it's going to go. Because the ministry hasn't been really committed to making a decision on that. And, you know, Kyle mentioned a lot of it too, that, you know, for students that kind of perform well in the classroom, but don't do well on tests because of the pressure, you know, you have to take that into account too. I was one of those students. Like my grade 8 teacher, science teacher, left a lot of the assignments up on a wall, and we had to use a textbook to be able to answer all those questions, and he would give us a date to submit those by. And he gave us about 3 weeks to do, you know, this is when this section is due by, and this is when this section is due by. And it was on you to be able to submit that on your own schedule by a certain date. So you could do it all in a week and submit it and be done with it, or you could take the whole, you know, 3 weeks by the due date and do it that way. And, that's something that I appreciated, because for me, it helped me better learn the stuff rather than having to take tests. And he was more in that same situation as well. He didn't like giving out tests. He liked helping us do the work if we needed help in the classroom. And that's where we kind of got our grades from. It was a unique thing to be experiencing when it came to that science class, but that was where I performed at my best because I sucked at tests. So we'll see where it lands. We'll see if the EQAO test will be canceled. Hopefully the Ministry of Education will have a decision coming up on that so school boards can kind of plan around it. Coming up after 2 o'clock, we'll talk to the mayor of Cambridge, Catherine McGarry, about the city initiating a plan to transform Hessler's Milling Road into a pedestrian-friendly district. And coming up at 2 o'clock on the news, Paul McPhee will take a look at the Region of Waterloo public health data numbers that were just released. This is City News 570, Kitchener Today with Brian Burke with James Sebastian Scott. Now is the time to seize the day. Now is the time to seize the day. Send out the call and join the fray. Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. James Sebastian Scott filling in for Brian. Heading into a conversation here about a plan to transform Hessler's Milling Road into a pedestrian-friendly district. And joining me on the show today is the mayor of Cambridge, Catherine McGarry, and Hardy Bromberg, the deputy city manager for the Community Development Department at the City of Cambridge, both joining me this afternoon. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So, Mayor McGarry, I guess I'll start with you when it comes to this plan. How important was it to be able to introduce a pedestrian-friendly district in Hespler to have for people who, are looking for something that to be a little bit more friendly when it comes to the pedestrians in that area?
It's a very exciting plan. I know it's been in the works for many years, I think 10 in total. And I think that community and council is really excited to see the possibilities. It's part of our Cambridge Connected strategic plan priorities for core revitalization, for placemaking, for recreation opportunities. This will be a real jewel in Hespler and good for all of the residents to come out and gather in a very wonderful space. So we're really excited about it.
Is this something that you heard a lot of from constituents in the area that wanted to see something done with that road? Because, to be honest, I live in Hespler. I see that road all the time, and usually it's just littered with parked cars.
Yes, but if you look at the site of this particular space, you've got a beautiful heritage building streetscape, the river in the background, and certainly there's a huge amount of development in the whole area right now, which is bringing new residents and new families. This will become a jewel, as I said, in the Hespler core village. And I think that everyone's been excited. This has not just been recently consulted on. When the report was developed, you could see that residents and community members and former councils have been looking to do this plan for well over 10 years. So I think that we've certainly appreciated the comments, but there is a great deal of enthusiasm to see some new space that takes advantage of these very unique and wonderful historic areas in our city.
Hardy, from your perspective, when it comes to this project, what was the most important thing, from your lens, to introduce this and to start working on with council to be able to come to fruition where it's now, going to come to fruition in that area?
Well, I think Mayor McGarry had already mentioned around our strategic plan, and that's something that city staff are focused on in terms of providing options and decision-making for council. And again, the strategic plan talks about a goal around prosperity, and that's focusing on strengthening our cores and creating an inviting downtown that connects and complements our core areas with neighborhoods where people want to live and want to visit. And so by this concept design, certainly it meets that goal. The other goal in our strategic plan is around place and placemaking. And that seems to be a real theme with both Mayor McGarry and the rest of our Cambridge Council about promoting and creating simply a wide range of destinations and activities that can capitalize on the beauty of the rivers and the heritage buildings. I mean, Cambridge is quite unique in not just Ontario, but throughout Canada. We have three distinct cores. We have a river running through each of them. We have an excellent array of heritage buildings, and certainly this touches on all those components. And so it's very exciting for staff and to hear the feedback that we did get from council around this opportunity.
When it comes to some of the comparisons that I've seen, of what the city will expect this to look like when it does come to fruition, to other examples that we've seen across southwestern Ontario, St. Lawrence Market comes to mind in Toronto. Is that kind of the idea that the city is looking for when it comes to what this space is actually going to look like when it is open to everyone to be able to use?
Yes, I would say so, if I can jump in there. And a lot of photographs from around the Southern Ontario were included in the report, including Toronto's Distillery District. And I think that's the beauty of the space that we're going to see redeveloped, that this will be, again, another unique destination. We see some of the benefits from tourism, from those that want to go and cycle and walk along these pedestrian areas. It'll be a community space, a community gathering space, and we can celebrate the unique features of our heritage, of our rivers, of the water feature with the dam, the mill pond. And again, that'll really support the businesses in our downtown core. And we have seen a number of new housing developments, Smart Center, Brant Haven, along Pine Bush, as well as developments within the village of Hespler. And so we really see this as a real core destination to satisfy so many things. So I think that this will really play well in the tourism sector among many area municipalities that are close to us.
And Hardy, for yourself, when you first saw kind of the plans to put this all together and present it to council and be able to, you know, stay along the ride, as you mentioned in the strategic plan to see this come to fruition, is that the same idea that you are hoping for this to look like for the residents of Hespler?
Yeah, absolutely. Having one of these warn-ups in our community, I think, is very important as we get into a little bit more of the placemaking type themes for our community. It's really exciting, and certainly I can't say this enough. Certainly staff and myself were very excited to hear the feedback that we got from council at this past Tuesday's meeting around the report, and certainly looking forward to seeing what this area can really become.
Mayor McGarry, this might be more of a question for you, but is this something that we can utilize in more festival spaces and using it as more of a community space? And when do we expect to be able to kind of see this come to fruition, where we can all go to and be able to really enjoy the space when it's ready to go?
I'll answer the last question first, and I know Mr. Bromberg will jump into that, but as soon as possible. I think there's certainly, during the pandemic, a great need to be outdoors and to start gathering again once the pandemic restrictions start to lift, which is good news. I think that there is a real appetite for our Cambridge residents to see spaces like this developed, and to recognize that these are the spaces that are going to connect our communities. It's going to connect us with the outside world as we see more tourists coming in. We will see many more suggestions coming forward as this plan develops from our community. And I would say that there is a great deal of eagerness amongst our community members to get this done as quickly as possible. The Mill Run cycling and walking trail is one of the best used in the city of Cambridge, and this will connect quite closely with that area. So we'll see a number of different families and individuals using this space for their enjoyment and as a community gathering space. So very excited again to see this going forward. But I think Hardy would probably be able to weigh in on the different phasings and the timings. Thank you.
Yeah, so James, if I could talk a little bit about, we obviously have a capital budget process, and here's my little plug in for council again with some of the significant decisions that they've recently made. You'll see this summer when you drive along Fountain Street, the construction getting underway for the soccer facility that the council has approved. We're in discussions right now with the design phase of the twinning the Preston Auditorium and renovating the existing ice pad to make it into an NHL-sized ice. Recently, council also endorsed a partnership with the ice park, in which the ice park is going to add an additional 2 ice pads to their existing facility to make it a quadplex. And then, of course, we're still proceeding with the recreation complex down at the south end of Cambridge. So some significant investments by this council in terms of updating our recreational facilities. And so this is part of that. And at budget time, we'll be preparing a list of potential capital projects for council's decisions. And we'll have to weigh the priorities at that time. But certainly this is a project that will be put forward, and we'll have to just weigh those with some of the other potential projects and certainly with an eye to our financial matters as well.
Mayor McGarry, when you kind of close your eyes and picture how this is all going to look when it's all done and be able to see people using the space, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you kind of take a look at the area and how nice it already is to be in that area, but how much nicer it will be once this whole project is kind of here for us to use when it will come to be?
Well, I'm smiling when I say this, but I see a real vibrant space for all seasons, for 12 months a year, with our community out enjoying the space, out walking, connecting with each other. I see it as a real bonus to a community space that will be well-loved and well-used in the future. And I'm really looking forward to hearing other suggestions by our community members as to how they'd like to see this space used. And I think that the word vibrant really sticks out in my mind. This will really help to revitalize the core, bring areas to our core area. And I can see that businesses in the surrounding area will certainly be thriving with the influx of so many that will want to come out and see this as a destination for either an afternoon, an evening, or a morning walk with their dog.
Mayor McGarry, another thing I wanted to ask you about was another crown jewel that has an anniversary today in Cambridge in Galt. So Galt Arena Gardens celebrating 100 years in operation. Just wanted to get your thoughts on that crown jewel in the city, also getting its time in the sun, marking the century history of memories at Galt Arena Gardens and what that arena brings to the community. Every single day throughout its history since it's been there. What are your thoughts on that anniversary?
This is a really important year for the Galt Arena Gardens, as it was known then. Again, another crown jewel in our city as the oldest known operating arena still in existence, not just in Ontario and Canada, but internationally. So it is time to really celebrate the achievement of what this building has meant in our community. So many have gone there to learn how to skate, whether it's hockey or figure skating. They've gone there to watch games and figure skating. They've gone to win gold medals, for instance. This is a really family-oriented facility that the city was really prudent to move ahead with some of the restoration, changes in the mid-90s to ensure it could be designated under Part 4 of the Ontario Heritage Act. And the fact that this arena continues to serve our community today in a really wonderful space. The skylights up at the top to allow natural light in there, the warm history that has been celebrated for so many years. Again, this is a really important space for our community. I know that it was this arena that I chose to take my children to when they were all learning to skate. And I know that families for generations now have done the same. So this is a very important landmark in our city's history. And I'm really hoping that we can get going on the 100 events that we're planning for this community jewel in the coming months. We have already missed one due to COVID restrictions, but as restrictions lift, we'll be able to see more and more of those events over the year. We're really hoping that people come out and enjoy them all this year.
I just wanted to take some time to thank both of you for joining the show today to discuss not just the Milling Road plan, but also for sharing your thoughts on the Galt Arena Gardens anniversary. Thank you both for taking the time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks very much, James.
Take care. That is the mayor of Cambridge, Catherine McGarry, and also Hardy Bromberg, the deputy city manager for the community development department at the city of Cambridge, talking about transforming Hespler's Milling Road into the pedestrian-friendly district that they have planned. It's going to be used when that come that plan comes to fruition and it gets revitalized and that sort of thing. You know, I live in Hespler. I see that area all the time. A lot of people like to use it use the road to park their cars and enjoy Jacob's Landing and the trail there as well. And some people like to you take walks along that stretch of area in Hespler too. So making it a pedestrian-friendly district, I think, is going to really, you know, spruce up that area and take kind of the cars out of there and make sure that we can use it as a community space. In the summertime, you know, there's a lot going on in Hespler when it comes to some of the things that, the city plans out. The Forbes Music Festival comes to mind in Forbes Park. And there's a lot, especially through the pandemic, we've seen Queen Street in that area shut down to have more patios on Saturdays. So that's another, thing that people can look forward to is another space to be able to use to their disposal, really. I think this is a good plan for that area. It kind of shines a light on the historic district of Hespler with the buildings in that area and the river running through, as Mayor McGarry mentioned and Hardy mentioned as well, that it just kind of lifts up the spirits a little bit of people who are able to use it as a community space instead of, having to navigate the parked cars on the road, right? I guarantee you right now, if you go down to that road, there's parked cars lining up that road right now. So it's definitely going to be a used community space for sure when it comes to, fruition here. So we're going to head to a break, and then after that, we'll come back with 2:30. We have What's Trending for Valentine's Day 2022. We'll have a discussion about that. And at 2:45, we'll have a discussion about the Humane Society's Thankful for the Betty White Challenge. We'll get into that right after the 2:30 and 2:45, but we'll head to a break, and we'll come back with more of Kitchener Today with Brian Burke with James Sebastian Scott.
It's a very exciting plan. It's part of our Cambridge Connected strategic plan priorities for core revitalization, for placemaking, for recreation opportunities. This will be a real jewel in Hespler and good for all of the residents to come out and gather in a very wonderful space. So we're really excited about it.
That was the mayor of Cambridge, Catherine McGarry, talking about the Milling Road of Revitalization that had the green light. It's been something that's been talked about at Cambridge Council for a number of years, and now it's gotten the green light, and things will start happening in that area to make it into a pedestrian-friendly space to use, anytime, I suppose, but especially during the summer. I mean, I take a look at Hespler, and anytime you go downtown Hespler in the summer, there's always lots of activity down there. And, I mentioned the Forbes Music Festival because that's a big piece of community in Hespler. Everyone flocks to that area for that music festival in the summer. There's a lot of good businesses in that area as well that people can go to. There's a Mill Run Trail, Jacob's Landing. There's some microbreweries in that area too, which I like to enjoy those quite a bit. My local brews. I think that's a lot of what people would want to do with that space in that area, because the saying is that it's a beehive for activity, and it kind of is. It rings true to its saying, right, in Hespler. So it's I think it's going to be a good piece of land for pedestrian friendly usage in the summertime, but also probably year round. They'll figure out what to do with it, during the winter time as well. So there's lots of options, lots of things that can happen with that space. And I'm certainly glad that they figured out something for that area and, maybe getting some of the parked cars off that road. We're going to come back with a conversation about what's popular for Valentine's Day in 2022. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke, James Sebastian Scott filling in on City News 570.
Talk to me. Ooh, I love the things you
Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. James Sebastian Scott filling in for Brian this afternoon. And a little bit of an interesting topic because this is something that I leave probably more to last minute than I should. And if my wife is listening, she'd probably call in and say that it's true that I do this a lot. But I do leave Valentine's Day to last minute a lot of the times. So maybe I can get a head start on what some of the best trending things are for Valentine's Day. And joining me this afternoon is Danny Boone, the head of live shopping at Showcase. Danny, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really stoked to be getting everybody ahead of the game for Valentine's this year. Because that's what Showcase is about. We're the home of the hottest trends. So you want to be on trend for Valentine's Day, right?
Listen, Danny, I need all the help I can get because I leave this way last minute than I should. But I leave everything last minute, like my Christmas shopping and everything like that. That's just what I do.
But buddy, you know what? We're all the same because the thing is, I think sometimes we always put it to chance because we want to keep pleasing people, right? And the beautiful thing that you're going to be finding now is because we've had all this time to research things. You can get out there. You can go online. You go to one of our Showcase stores. We have 119 across the country, and we have 5 in the Waterloo area, in Kitchener, Guelph, Cambridge. And we can get you anything that you need that is on trend. So if you've seen it in TikTok, if you've seen it on Instagram or Facebook, and you think, hey, I think that would make a great Valentine's present, you're going to be able to find it in our store or online when you shop at Showcase, okay?
All right, I'm ready for it. So what are some of the trends that you're seeing here, Danny, in the research that you've done?
It's huge because the funny thing is, I mean, what's the thing that you would like for Valentine's Day right now? Let me see if I can hit you on the trend.
Anything beer related would be good.
Well, we have fantastic beer glasses at Showcase. But I'm telling you now, the big thing when you talk about on-trend foods and drink would be the Dalgona cookie. You may have seen the Dalgona cookie challenge that was in we have a brand called K-Game, but it was also in the Netflix show, Squid Game. And what we've developed is we're North America's leader in the unique shapes of Dalgona cookies. So for Valentine's Day, we have a pink Dalgona cookie with a heart. So you can challenge your loved one by picking out the heart of the Dalgona cookie. And if you break the heart, you lose the game. So that's the big part there. And then when we move on, you didn't laugh at that one, Brian.
And my microphone was off. I did have a little bit of a chuckle there.
Here, you know? also, we've got a brilliant, and everyone loves a massage. It doesn't matter if you're getting down and romantic or if you just need to recuperate from a long workout. The big thing is massage guns right now. We have a wide selection of massage guns. And some of them are actually the best in price in the market right now. And then we have, I've got to say, the safest gift that you can get anybody this year is the Hidden Gems candle. Okay. Now, if you gave somebody a candle, you think, well, that's kind of a neutral gift, right? You think, well, it's going to be scented, it's going to be nice, it's going to set the mood. But how about this? With every Hidden Gems candle that we sell, you've got the chance of gaining or winning, I should say, $9,000.
I'm in. I'm listening.
so basically, it's a win-win. You get the safest gift on the market. Okay, it's something beautiful, something that's going to set the ambiance of the evening, maybe for Valentine's Day or any time that you should have. But the bigger thing here is you've always got this chance to find a gem worth up to $9,000. I think it's absolutely amazing. We've got some videos up on our website when you shop at showcase.com. And when you go there, you'll be able to see literal people. We've had lots of customers there and then burn the candle. It's a slow burning soy candle as well. So it's going to take a little bit of time to get there. So you're going to really get your money's worth. But the thing is to get that hidden gem at the end there and have the anticipation of, oh, wow, I could win $9,000 or have a valuation of a gem that's $9,000. The lowest we saw was 150. So, I mean, you're still getting a candle that's going to set the mood and have that great prize at the end of it.
How popular have these candles been in previous years there, Danny? Is this something that typically Showcase has seen, people flock to get for Valentine's Day?
Yeah. The funniest thing is because we're always on trend and we have everything on trend, everything, even from fidget toys at the moment, we have a heart shape pop and play, is, you know, be great for high schoolers and lower, great stress relief. But when you talk about candles being an on trend thing, they are, I think they always rise right to the top around now and Christmas or the holidays, because obviously it sets the mood. And what a brilliant, you know, gift to give. Also, those Dalgona cookies I was saying, is it's an on-trend product right now. It's really, really, you know, Squid Game brought it to light. But K-Game brings it to another level because we're giving such unique cookies, you know, obviously not giving them away because we've always got the best prices, but we don't give anything away. But the whole idea is to keep you on-trend and keep you bringing you back to having, you know, the most in-the-moment present gift, or, you know, gift to yourself at any time of the year.
And any other, aside from the, you know, Squid Game stuff, because that really boosted in popularity when it came to it being on Netflix. But is there anything else that stands out as a trend other than the candle and the Dalgona cookies that really, you know, is sort of unique and you know, is being seen as a trend for kind of a first time?
Well, you know, the strangest thing is trends recycle, but when it really does come down to, I think what lockdown brought us is about self-appreciation and self-maintenance and mental awareness and really being able to understand about stress levels. So the massage guns have got big. We have also cocktail bombs have become a big thing. A huge trend. And because people are looking for variety. And I think that's the beautiful thing about showcases. We offer so much variety, you know, and, you know, we've got 119 stores coast to coast. And what we do offer and what people know us for is, if you're looking for something that little bit unique, that little bit different, that little bit more personable, we've got it in store and online for you.
Danny, what's the one thing that you would say, you know, year after year after year is something that always stays on trend and it never really goes away when it comes to Valentine's Day?
Candy. Absolutely, right? Candy's your number one. But this is the other thing, because we're on trend. If you've seen any taste challenge, any candy trend on TikTok right now, it is in store and online at Showcase. And I mean everything, that the sours, the one thing that got me when I was looking through our research is the candy sours that were like, I don't know who would get this for somebody for Valentine's Day, but they're going out like hotcakes right now because people want to test and challenge each other. I think when we've spent so much time together and we're also forming new relationships, I think people are always trying to see whose boundaries can be pushed. So challenges are one of our biggest trends, from K-Game to fidget toys to candy. That is the big trend that either recycles itself or is literally going to be around for a long time to come.
Nothing says love like competing your significant other in a game and potentially souring the mood a little bit if you win, eh?
Exactly. Well, listen, let's take the cocktail bombs and let's have – and they're non-alcoholic cocktail bombs. So what they do is they're obviously what are they called? They're beautiful flavors. I was trying to think of what they're not. They're false cocktails. What's the word of it? I'm sorry. I had a complete brain there.
That's okay.
Mocktail.
Mocktails. There you go.
That's it. Mocktail. So with the mocktail, I've got to say, I think that's the big thing that people are really diving into, because it's different flavors, different combinations. There's no alcohol involved, so everybody can try. And that's another eyebrow raiser that I'm seeing right now.
Danny, I think you've gotten me prepared to not leave this to last minute now. I think everything is lining up where I can sort of see where I'm headed with a Valentine's Day gift potentially.
I tell you, don't leave it too late. The greatest thing about what we do at Showcase right now is you can get DoorDash delivery same day, so you won't even be late. Okay, you could even get it same day if you do forget, and if you've got a little extra time, we also do speedy FedEx delivery.
Awesome. There you go. Well, Danny, thanks so much for taking the time today to share some of those trends and getting us last-minute shoppers ready for Valentine's Day. Appreciate you doing that today.
That's it. Have a great holidays and a great Valentine's, everybody. See you soon.
Take care, Danny. Thanks so much. That was Danny Boone from Showcase just telling us about some of the trends he's seeing and the research that they've done when it comes to what's trending for Valentine's Day. My wife loves candles. I'm sure she would love to dig out a jewel that may be worth some money. That might be a unique gift you could give someone for Valentine's Day. But the other thing, too, is that, you know, not everyone has a significant other on Valentine's Day either. So you gotta look at the self-care portion of it, too, right? So if, you know, there's some things out there that you want to get just for yourself for Valentine's Day because, you know, you want to celebrate, too, with you know, what's going on in your life, then you can do some self-care, too, right? And that's also an option that Danny mentioned. And I think it helps to know what's kind of on trend for Valentine's Day before we head out to get anything for that day there. So thanks to Danny for joining us today. On the other side, we're going to go to a break. We're going to speak to Nick Burke from the Kitchener-Waterloo-Stratford-Perth Humane Society about the Betty White Challenge, and we'll explain that coming up right after 2:45. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke on City News 570.
News 570.
Welcome back to Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. James Sebastian Scott filling in for Brian on City News 570 here. We're heading into a conversation now about the Betty White Challenge. And joining us now this afternoon is Nick Burke, the Director of Development for the Kitchener-Waterloo and Stratford-Perth Humane Society. And Nick joining us to give us an idea of how the Betty White Challenge happened. Good afternoon, Nick, and thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, James, how are you? Thanks for having us.
Doing well, thanks. Just kind of go into detail, Nick, a little bit about what the Betty White Challenge was and how it's helping, you know, the Humane Society here.
Of course. I mean, as I'm sure a lot of people have heard about the Betty White Challenge, you know, after Betty passed, there was this social movement that that kind of exploded on social media, encouraging people to give, you know, make donations in small amounts, as small as $5, to their local animal shelters and animal rescue agencies around the world. So of course we took part of that particular challenge, you know, the money that we raised over the last week or so, as people were talking about this Betty White Challenge, has been phenomenal, and the money that we've raised will really go and help a lot of animals in our community.
How much money did you expect to raise versus how much money was actually raised? Was there kind of a goal in mind, or was it just, you know, thankful that people were kind of reaching into their pockets during a pandemic to try and help out in any way they can?
Yeah, to be perfectly honest, we really didn't have a goal because this is something that's never really happened before. We weren't really sure what to expect. So we really didn't have a goal in mind. That on top of the fact that we have just come out of one of our biggest campaigns of the year throughout November and December, our Hope for the Holidays campaign. So we didn't really expect, we didn't have an expectation. We are constantly worried about donor fatigue throughout the year, especially throughout this pandemic. As of, you know, 1:32 on Monday, when all these donations were coming in, we were at about $30,000 estimated. That number's now gone up to about $49,000. But on Monday alone, we had received over 1,500 individual donations. So it might take us a few days to actually work through all of those donations and find a full total number, but we are absolutely humbled and very, very gracious and grateful about the support that we've received over the last few days.
What sort of services, I guess, will this money be put towards to when it comes to the Humane Society? How are Humane Societies across, and not just in our region, but across Ontario, going to use that money to be able to help with the animals' needs at the Humane Society there?
Well, I can only speak for our two centers in Kitchener and in Stratford, but, you know, we always have animals coming into our centers that need immediate medical assistance. This money will help us provide surgeries and medication and treatments for animals that need help. Great example, on Christmas Eve, we had an animal that had come into us that was showing signs of distress and needed emergency surgery to remove two obstructions. Foreign bodies from the cat's, I think it was its digestive tract, but You know, we're always running into situations like this where animals need immediate care. So the money that we raise on Monday will definitely help give animals the best chance at recovering and having a second chance at life. Not only that, we'll look at programs that we run that need our support. For instance, our foster program. Over the last few years of the pandemic, we've been trying to get as many animals as we can out of our shelters and into foster care to recuperate from surgery or receive medical treatment. So the funds that we've raised on Monday, and you know, even up to today, we're receiving donations for Betty. But that money will go to help make sure that all of those animals have the treatment, the care, the medication, and anything else that they may need to fully recover and then be ready to be adopted out into our community.
How important was it, I suppose, that something like this movement was attached to a name like Betty White's, but not just her name, but her love for animals as well? Like, what does that mean to the Humane Society to know that people were making these donations in Betty White's name, knowing that she was an animal lover and it was something that was close to her heart, that they could carry on kind of that legacy for her?
Yeah, I mean, Betty White was just an absolute force. I mean, she was a favorite to almost everyone just because of how she acted and how long she was in the industry. I mean, everyone was a really big fan of Betty, and not a lot of people knew about all of the animal activity that she did. She sat on boards. She was on the American Humane Board for, I think, over 30 years. She's been a trustee of a zoo. She's donated her time and money and volunteered. So Betty did so much for the animal welfare world that it's incredible to think that she's still having such a huge impact after she's gone. Of course, we'd prefer her to still be around for many reasons, but really at the end of the day, we're humbled and honored that individuals that had decided to give money in Betty's name decided to give it to us. So it definitely... it's definitely nice to see that the community trusts us to do the job that we're here to do and provide the services for the community. But it really speaks to how great Betty was and the legacy that she left, and hopefully it lives on for quite a while.
Yeah, Nick, I was just going to ask you that. This seems like it could have only just been, you know, one-time thing, but is there hope that this continues year after year where, the Betty White Challenge kind of resurfaces every January around her birthday and the Humane Society still can rely on some of that support too? Like, is that the hope behind this?
Well, I mean, that's the rumors and the talk that we've heard. Some rumors that January 17th is going to be Betty White Day moving forward, and that humane societies and animal rescues and other organizations will use that as an opportunity to remember her, but also generate some donations. So we expect that it'll be an annual thing. We'll see what transpires nationally and internationally, but. For us, I think it was more about recognizing the contributions that Betty made, and making sure that people understood what she did for the animal world, as opposed to making donations. We're flattered that we were able to make so much money, and that people were willing to donate to us. But for us, that wasn't the goal. The goal was really more to share Betty's story and let everyone know how great she was in the animal world.
What's some of the most important work that's done within a Humane Society for those who might not know, what a Humane Society is meant to do every single day for animals and the welfare of animals?
You know, it's a great question, and I could spend 45 minutes telling you about everything that we do, because we have, you know, over 40 programs and services that we provide, from, you know, obviously our adoptions, and we have emergency boarding for people who have run into a difficult situation of, you know, temporarily displaced. We have a low-cost spay and neuter clinic at our Stratford clinic. We have microchips and rabies clinics. We do all kinds of things in the community that, you know, not everyone may know about. The best way to find out about all of those programs and services is to visit our website, which is kwsphumane.ca.
and check out some of the things that we do in the community. You know, we're a very versatile organization that provides a lot of services, but, you know, of course, as an organization that receives no government funding, you know, we rely on the support and the donations from our community to be able to do what we've been asked to do in our community.
Nick, thanks so much for taking the time today to join us on the show and to kind of give us an update on how much money was raised with this challenge this year. I appreciate you doing that.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us. And anytime, give us a call.
Take care, Nick. Thanks so much. That was Nick Burke from the Humane Society here locally, just talking about some of the donations received for the Betty White Challenge. And joining me now in studio, animal lover himself, Paul McPhee. He has a pup at home. Paul, what's coming up on the afternoon news here?
Well, of course, we will have the full rundown of the provincial announcement today regarding the gradual lifting of some pandemic restrictions as well. We're getting some local reaction to that.
And the reaction to that is kind of mixed. I saw a little bit here. Anything else coming up in the sporting world that we should know about?
Well, there's a report today that Major League Baseball has said no to a proposed plan that would have seen the Rays and the Expos, one more time. The Rays split their schedule between Tampa Bay and Montreal.
That's an interesting perspective, too. And Mother Nature, is it going to be kind to us coming up here, or are we going to see some snow in the forecast?
Later in the week, some snow. Right now, generally uneventful, but cold.
Cool.
For the next few days. Yeah, minus 20 tonight, somewhere around there.
That's just a brisk summer for me. Thanks, Paul. Paul and Aaron coming up with the afternoon news at 3 o'clock. They'll have all the reaction to the provincial government's announcement today of the restrictions lifting come at the end of the month and the three-prong plan that we talked about on the show as well. This is Kitchener Today with Brian Burke. Thanks to everyone who joined me on the show today and for sitting through 3 hours of this guy yapping where you don't expect me to yap for 3 hours, but you got through it. Thanks so much for everyone joining me, and we'll head to the news at 3 o'clock with Aaron and Paul. I'm James Sebastian Scott on City News 570.